Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. This evening's event is presented by the Center for the Study of Europe at Boston University and features a reading and conversation with poet and novelist Kieran Carson. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler.
I'm honored this evening to welcome Kieran Carson and his wife, Deirdre Shannon, to Boston. Poet and novelist Kieran Carson was born in Belfast, Northern Ireland, in 1948. I hope it's okay that I tell. After graduating from Queen's University Belfast, he worked for the Arts Council of Northern Ireland until 1998. He won an Eric Gregory Award in 1978. His collections of poetry include The Irish for No, 1987, winner of the Alice Hunt Bartlett Award, Belfast Confetti, 1990, which won the Irish Times Irish Literature Prize for Poetry, and First Language Poems, 1993, winner of the T.S. Eliot Prize. His prose includes The Star Factory, a 1997 memoir, Fishing for Amber, and his novel, Shamrock Tea, explores themes present in Jan van Eyck's painting, The Arnolfini Marriage. His translation of Dante's Inferno was published in November 2002. His volume, Breaking News, 2003, won the Forward Poetry Prize. His poetry collection, For All We Know, was shortlisted for both the 2008 T.S. Eliot Prize and the Costa Poetry Award. Until, Before, After, his 2010 volume, was shortlisted for the 2011 Irish Times Poetry Now Award. He is also an accomplished musician and is author of Last Night's Fun, about time, food, and music, a study of Irish traditional music. He lives in Belfast and is director of the Seamus Heaney Center for Poetry at Queen's University. Carson's work is bound inextricably to his home city of Belfast, its history, its topography, its place names, and to Irish music, the improvisational quality of which influences much of his work. As in Sean Noe's, Irish for Old Style, a highly ornamented style of unaccompanied traditional Irish singing, in Carson's poems you find patterns of ornamentation and moments of melodic freedom. As Walter Potter says, all art aspires to the condition of music. His poems are dense with literary reference and other kinds of linguistic association. Ode to a nightingale and onomatopoeia sound out in his pages. If you look closely enough, connections and patterns between colors, forms, sounds, and even smells emerge. John Banville sees him as rather like the Irish language poets of the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. He's a kind of journeyman poet. He makes poetry out of the everyday things of life. In the best sense, he's a throwback to an earlier time. We're grateful to have him in ours. I welcome Kieran Carson.
Thank you. We began the evening with an air of a song of a genre known in Irish as the Aisling, that's spelled A-I-S-L-I-N-G. And usually what happens in the Aisling is that the author of the Aisling is asleep. And the Aisling that you have heard is indeed called Táim Sim Hullu, which means I am sleeping. Because when the author of the Aisling is out one evening and he's going home and he gets tired after a long evening out and he lies down at the side of the road and he falls asleep, and in his sleep he sees a beautiful female come to him and say, "O author of the Aisling, what are you doing lying asleep in the ditch, not attending to my cause? You should arise from your slumber and do something about it." And he does. He gets up the next morning. He writes about what he saw and what he felt and what it's all about. The Aisling was at its height at a time when Irish as a language in Ireland, it was at an ebb. And the English language is starting to come in a lot more. So often the author is accused of not only not saying anything about her cause, that he, if he does, it's in English, and that won't do because it's the foreign tongue and everything. Howsoever, I write in English, albeit that I learned English at the age of, well, 4, I guess, on the streets. But that idea, I think that the Aisling is also, to me, some kind of strange zone in which you enter, but not off the ordinary world, it's from elsewhere. It's the idea of going into somewhere else that is like a dream vision, you know. And that's what it is. I've been haunted for some time by a poem in the Irish language by a poet called Sean O'Riordan from Cork. It's a poem called Mallarch in the Irish language, which can mean a lot of things, including exchange, swap, alteration, an opposite of, a match for. And in Irish it starts off, Gavilech ers a turnbull, gavegatu, and brom, a soul of a chapel, da me a kruba homor lo shin futsa, fed brom, the hull of homatlish. And in English it might go like this. Come over here, said Turnbull, till you see the sorrow in the horse's eyes. Had you such heavy hooves as these for feet, there would be sorrow in your eyes too. And it was clear to me that he had understood the sorrow in the horse's eyes so well, so deeply had he contemplated it, that he was steeped in the horse's mind. I looked over at the horse that I might see the sorrow pouring from its eyes, and saw instead the eyes of Turnbull looking at me from the horse's head. I looked at Turnbull, twice I looked at him, and saw in his face the over big eyes that were dumb with sorrow, the horse's eyes. And that idea of stepping into the shoes of another, I mean, I do often step into the shoes of another language. As you know, as I've just heard, I've done translations from Irish, from French, from Italian, and so forth and so on. And it's hard to know at the end of the day if you have a language of your own, whose language is it? It actually owns you, I think, if anything. I'm going to read a poem which I think is an Aisling of sorts. When I get my bearings, and here they are. Here are the bearings. '98 was a big year in Ireland. Stuff was hoped to happen, but as usual, that's not the way it works out. 1798. I met her in the garden where the poppies grow, quite over canopied with luscious woodbine, and her cheeks were like roses or blood dropped on snow. Her pallid lips were red with papal Spanish wine. Lulled in these wild flowers with dance and delight, I took my opportunity and grasped her hand. She then disclosed the eyelids of her second sight and prophesied that I'd forsake my native land. Before I could protest, she put her mouth to mine and sucked the broken English from my Gaelic tongue. She wound me in her briary arms of eglantine. 2 centuries have gone, yet she and I abide like emblems of a rebel song, no longer sung, or snowy blossoms drifting down the mountainside. Belfast confetti was a slang term for the kind of things that might be employed in a riot. Bits of stones, rocks, bottles, whatever is at hand, you know. Belfast confetti. Suddenly, as the riot squad moved in, it was raining exclamation marks, nuts, bolts, nails, car keys, a fount of broken type, and the explosion itself, an asterisk on the map. This hyphenated line, a burst of rapid fire. I was trying to complete a sentence in my head, but it kept stuttering, all the alleyways and side streets blocked with stops and colons. I know this labyrinth so well, Balaclava, Raglan, Inkerman, Odessa Street, why can't I escape? Every move is punctuated, Crimea Street, dead end again, a Saracen, Kremlin II mesh, Macrolon face shields, walkie-talkies. What is my name? Where am I coming from? Where am I going? A fusillade of question marks. And I think we'll play a tune at this stage. Give my voice a rest. This is 2 hornpipes, which we learned from we don't quite know where. Stuff just comes out of the air, you know, who we heard it first played. That's just out there. Somebody played it, but we can't remember who. So it's that idea of the other world, that you learned it somewhere where you don't know where you were, in a strange back room, in a pub in County Galway, or not. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to read two poems, of which one is called O and the other is called K. I once wrote a poem a long time ago, and as sometimes happens with poems, the hardest bit is a title. You know the title? You know that bit about the title? What are you going to call your poem? Ode to a Nightingale. You know, spring? You know. If you remember back in the 70s or the 60s or sometime like that, you'd get this guy on the stage and said, I'm going to read some poems here. The first one is called One. And you're thinking, how many? You know? Yeah. And he goes, 12. And you go, 13. Anyway, I decided that I'd call my poem X. So then I thought, why not have ones called A and B and C and H and K and Z, you say here? Z, we say, you know, that kind of thing. So here's one called O. The teacup stained on the white damask tablecloth was not quite perfect. Nevertheless, I'd set my cup exactly on it like it was a stain remover. I sipped the rim with a palatable lip. I drank the steaming liquor up. My granny then would read my future from the tea leaves, leavings in the cup. I stirred into enormous china O and saw its every centrifugal flaw. The tiny bubbles glazed in its interior of Delphic oracle. I yawned into its incandescent blaze of a vowel like the cool of dudes in Blackford auras at high noon, trigger-fingered shadowless, they walked beneath sombreros. They stopped me inadvertently and asked for my identity. I did not know until the mouth of a gun was pressed against my forehead and I felt it. Oh. And this is one called K. When I was in Japan some time ago, I was interested to learn that karaoke in Japanese means empty orchestra. Thought I could use that. I'm only an empty orchestra man, you know. I just speak the words, it's not me. You know. K. K is the leader of the empty orchestra of karaoke. K is the conductor on the wrong bus that you took today and landed you in yesterday, where everything was skew, the rainbow colors were all out of kilter, like oil had leaked out all over the road from a dropped and broken filter. There no one wanted to be recognized and walked around and wrapped around Polaroids. There was Semtex in the Maxwell house and 20 shillings in the pound. Came into it again with the sidelong arm stance of a pharaoh. He took my Copac, docked it with two holes and told me it was time to go. All the motor cars were black. I got behind the wheel of one. It worked okay. Welder's sparks zipped from the trolley. The radio was playing karaoke. Look at the time here. You always have to watch your time. I'm going to read 12 poems. And after that, I might read, you know, I don't know, an epic here. You know. We'll play a march because I will do some stuff about war. I'm going to read some translations or adaptations, I'm not quite sure exactly what they are, from Arthur Rimbaud, who wrote poetry from about the age of 16 till the age of 20 or something, and then he stopped writing. And what he wrote in those few small years was mad stuff. And he wrote poems and prose, and they're not quite poems and not quite prose, and they're poems which I had at the back of my mind for many, many years. I looked at them about 7 years ago with an eye to, you know, adapting them or doing a version of them at least or something, and I couldn't do it because it was prose. And it just was flat, it came out all wrong, it came out, it hadn't any kind of spark in it, you know. And then I was asked, would I translate some of them for a show called Illumination, or Illuminations, which might be about his work, or might be about the idea of Illumination, or Illuminations of the work. And I thought, but I tried that and I can't do it. And you know what happened to me? I fell asleep. And in my dream, possibly the spirit of Arthur Rimbaud appeared to me, as a woman, you know, but as he would, you know, I think, you know, because he was a naughty boy. Rimbaud did some unspeakable things, which I can't speak of. I mean, really unspeakable things. He was dirty, you know, But he was wonderful, you know. And he told me, right in the old French classical measure, the Alexandrine line, which rhymes and scans very formally, 12 syllables a line, rhyming all the way through. I thought, what a brilliant idea. And I did. And it struck me as I did them that there is a sense in which they're all about Aisling. Aisling to me is about elsewhereness. That in the poems you're in a strange region between the ordinary world that you imagine you know and the world of your imagination and the world in between it, and you don't know. I mean, and these poems, I don't know what they say or what they mean especially, because they're in another world which you just go, strange world, wow, you know. To say what they say, well, that's what they say. You know. But as I said, there was an aspect of them that I certainly thought was all about that Aisling thing, that you're entering into, you know, the Celtic twilight zone, you know, that kind of thing, you know. You are now entering the Celtic twilight zone. Gorilla on a plane, you know, on a wing, you like, you know. And they're also in the spirit of an Irish song. So I'll start off with one which I call in English As I Roved Out, because that's how it goes. As I roved out upon a May morn, on a May morning quite early, I met my love upon the way, da 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 da, and so forth. And so on. He calls it Obe Dawn. A voice came from elsewhere telling me not to read that poem. No, that's okay. I embraced the summer dawn. All was still before the palaces, their waters dead forevermore. Shade after shadowed lingered on the woodland road. I woke quick, live, warm clouds of breath as on I strode. The gemstones eyed my passing, wings arose without sound. My first adventure happened on a path I found, already littered with pale glints, wherein a flower spoke her name to me. I blinked, it was no known hour. I laughed to see the Wasserfall disheveling itself in shocks among the pines. Climbing shelf by rocky shelf, I recognized the goddess of the silver peak. Voila, veil after veil I lifted from her, not to speak of how my arms were fluttering as I did so. I did it in the lane, and boldly did I go across the plain where I had betrayed her to the cock. She fled to the city under the steeple clock, and beggar-like I tailed her on the marble quays. Far up the road beneath the grove of laurel trees, I wound her in those recollected veils and realized just a little something of her massive shape and size. Then dawn and child, finding themselves in the wood, sank down deep into it on waking. It was noon. Swan called. He calls it actually fairy, as an English word, F-A-I-R-Y, so I thought it ought to be called in English fae, fae being a fairy in French. Understand me. It's not my fault. He called it fairy in French. And I was saying, how do you translate that into English? You know? And all you can do is say fae as they have it in French. And what it means, I have no idea. All for Helen, ornamental oozing saps collogued in virgin shadows, silent, unmoved, glittering the astral road. Summer's torrid heat was given over to the mute birds, inevitable languor to an expensive funeral barge through winding estuaries of loves long dead, and perfumes like an evanescent freshet overlaid the chorus of the timber women to the rumble of the torrents through the ruined wood from the cowbells in the valleys echoing the long cries of the steps, all for Helen, bushy furs and shadows quivered, bee skips oozed, the poor shivered, shimmering the celestial legends. And her eyes, her dancing, far superior to a thousand precious dazzles coldly flowing in, or to the pleasure of that unique decor, that one and only R. I'm having a look at the R, at the one and only R. I hope it's only an R they're saying, you know. I'm going to end what I'm going to read with a sermon of a kind, and then Dodo and I will end with a tune or two. Okay. It's the only one of the poems that I didn't do, in fact, in the Alexandrine line. This one is in prose, because it's longish, you know, for a start, and if you were to do it, it'd be hard, you know, and diverse. So it was like a sermon in my ear. Jenny. He is affection, and he is the present, since he has made the house open to the foam of winter and to the murmur of summer. He who has purified the drinks, the food, he who is the charm of fleeting places and the superhuman joy of lingering. He is affection, and he is the future, love and strength which we upright in our rages and our boredom see flitting through the tempestuous sky and the ecstatic banners. He is love. He is perfect, reinvented measure. He is marvelous and unexpected reason and eternity, beloved instrument of fatal qualities. We have all known the terror of his concessions and of ours. O thrill of health, the swooping upwards of our faculties, our self-considering affection and our passion for him, He who loves us for his unending life. And we remember him, and he journeys. And if the adoration bell resounds and goes, so does the bell of his promise. Away, superstitions, away. Those former bodies, those menages, those ancient times, away. Ours is the era that has foundered. He will not go away. He will not descend again from any heaven to redeem the wrath of women, nor the gaiety of men, nor all the sin, for it is done, he being and being loved. Oh, the surges of his breathing, head following head, his swooping off, oh, terrible celerity in the perfecting of forms and action. Oh, fecundity of mind, the immensity of the universe, his body, the dream deliverance, the shattering of grace crossed by new violence. To behold him and behold him, all the ancient genuflections and penalties revoked at his passing, his day, the abolition of all sonorous and arbitrary sufferings in a more plangent music. His step, vaster than migrations, than ancient invasions. Oh, him and us, pride more compassionate than squandered charities. Oh, world, the glassy song of fresh disasters. He has known us all and has loved us all. May we learn this winter night from tumultuous pole to castle, cape to rocky cape, from crowd to beach, from glance to gaze, our strength and feelings ebbed, to hail him and to see him, to return him to his echo. And from under the tides and high in the wastes of snow, to follow all that he beholds, the surges of his breathing, his body, and his day. Thank you. Thank you, brethren. We'll end up with a tune called The Skylark. The one after is called Happy to Meet and Sorry to Part.
I think the obvious place to begin is with music. You transition so beautifully from playing to reading poems. When I hear the music, I'm taken to that elsewhere place. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about the influence of music.
Yeah,
on
well,
your poems.
At the back of all I do in writing, you know, or words or language, there's an absolute sense that there has to be somewhere in back a sense of a melody to it, or that there's a song in back there somewhere, or that it's haunting me. Right. It's something I've heard somewhere, but I don't know how it works. Mm. You know, and when you start to learn on the flute, it's very interesting to me how you learn a tune. Mm. You hear it somewhere, and you go away, and you don't know where you heard it. You'd be around, and you know, you'd be on the go from, you know, Antrim to Donegal to Connemara to somewhere other, and you come back, and this thing is in your ear, just. And then you hear it again from whoever else, and then bit by bit you start to assemble an idea of how it is. Mm-hmm. It goes like this, you know, da dee da dee da da dee da 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 dee da da da. But you know what? It took me a while to know that it goes like that, you know. And it's that stage where you work out how it goes, but you don't know how it goes. And to me, in language, if you know how it goes already, it's no use to you. Because if you know it already, it's no fun arriving at that exploration of how it might go, right, or how it will go. And it often happens, a tune that you imagine that you've learned just perfect, and you're out and you're playing it, and something else, and then you realise the wee bits at the end are the toughest. The wee things that don't appear to matter much. As in language, stuff like of, through, for, to, with, all those wee words in the English language can transform a sentence.
Right.
So it's getting to arrive at something that you kind of hear in there of elsewhere, mm-hmm, but you don't know how it goes until it's written.
Right.
You know, so it's not arriving at it by happenstance. Almost, you know.
When you chose a title for your version of Rimbaud's Illuminations, you chose In the Light Of.
Yeah, of, again, as the key word, I think. Of is the key word. Is it often the sense of from?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or in the sense of as?
Right.
Of is what, you know? Is it of his language? In the light of how it's seen? In the light of how it's observed? In the light of how it's heard? In the air. I mean, I don't know French. I mean, I know French, you know, up to a point. But there's a level if you're not from that background of being a francophone,
with
all the history that goes behind it and what you've read in French, and being French, for God's sake, like, you know, it's a whole other world, you know. And that idea of that the attempt to enter an elsewhere of which you don't know very much, it's a skim. But all you can do, I mean, I was interested in the poems in French, and I started off with not knowing what they meant, as one does. You said, what's he saying here? So again, it's that idea that if you know what you're doing in writing, it can be bad for you.
Yeah.
You know? And you have to hear another melody that haunts you just, and you don't know exactly how to do it. If you know how it's done in advance.
Is this what happened when you wrote Belfast Confetti? Was a number of sounds that led you to write
I wrote those poems fast at the time. I mean, and I look back at it now, and you know how they were done. I have no idea, you know. I hadn't in mind it happened that way.
And
you know,
so much of that poem itself turns on the sounds of the street. Of something rolling in the road.
Yeah. It's about that. I mean, it's like the fact that if you write a poem, you're involved in a landscape which you don't quite know. Mm-hmm. You're going into unknown territory here, you know, into dark woods, you know, stopping by woods on a snowy evening is going into a hinterland of darkness, you know. Whose woods these are, I think I know. You know, it's kind of uneasy at the start, isn't it, you know? His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. I mean, it's an odd poem. It's an eerie poem. By happenstance, I was in Amherst in the USA here, you know, where he stayed for a while, I think.
Yeah.
There's a frost house there, I believe. And I was in Amherst sometime back in the 80s or 90s, you know, I can't remember when. And I read there, and the first thing that struck me is that before I should start on my own work, I should say, stopping by woods on a snowy evening. So I did that from heart, as it were, you know. And at the end of my reading, an old snowy-haired man approached me, wearing a nice suit, you know. But he was about 80, you know, I guess, you know. And I was younger then, you know. And anyway, he said to me, "Mr. Carson, the last time I heard that poem recited aloud, it was by Robert Frost. And he was standing right where you're standing now, sir." And I said, "Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Praise the Lord. Praise the Frost." You know, whatever. You know. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it just shows you that you never know what's going to happen to you. And that's a poem which actually, as an adolescent, I scorned, much to my eternal shame. When I was a young lad writing poetry at the age of 15 or 16 or something, I'm like Robert Frost, simple-minded, rhyming nonsense. Because what you did then, you know, free verse, man, you know, and you expressed yourself and your ideas about, you know, who you are and what you feel like, you know, and all the stuff. And here's this simple little poem, banal, it would seem. And you know what? I still don't know what it means. There's levels of meaning in that poem that just come up again and again and again. It's so transparent, limpid, simple, simple, apparent poetry. But the more I age, the more I admire it. You know, it's... And a poem is that. A poem is something that will alter you and alter all the time. It won't stay the same for you. The poem that you read 5 years ago and how it is now for you, it's another deal. If it's not another deal, it's no good. It doesn't work. You know, if you think it stays the same, it's bad for the poem and you, my friend.
Heaney says it creates a settlement in you over time.
It does. Absolutely, yeah. He would say that. Sediment, you know, bogland, I know. Silt, yeah, yeah. Levels of turf, I know, yeah. If only we had one, you know. But you know,
to warm our toes. You are a consummate craftsman, and over the years you have set yourself a number of formal challenges. You translated Dante, Zarema, you translated Anglo-Saxon poetry.
Yeah, it's all this challenge stuff, so I know.
What has been, for you, the most difficult challenge, and what's been the most successful in those translations? And in those formal challenges?
They all have their own aspects. Each one of them in their own ways was about me trying to find a way into it, understanding the poem just right. At the end of the day. It's all I had in mind is to try and get a handle on what it means to me, which is not how it is in French or Irish or you know. It's about that idea that, and because it's a challenge, you have to do things that you wouldn't do. If you're doing Dante, nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita, mi ritrovai per una selva scura che la carita via era sparita. And I wanted to get a handle on that, and I read English translations. I read scores of English translations, terribly dead, polite, highfalutin nonsense. If you want to do a translation of something, you have to go into it and not know, and you have to be afraid of it. And I was terrified by it, you know. And I labored at it, I remember, for some months, and a sort of, you know, free versey style. It's just, there's no energy to it. And you know what I said? That has to be done in Terzarima. And I got over that too because at the back of my mind, I suddenly realised that Dante could be sung to an air of an Aisling. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita, che la terita via, you know, et cetera, you know. And because terza rima means that you don't just have your standard pair of rhymes, you have to have three rhymes. So you have a rhyme there, something there, rhyme there, something there, rhyme there. But the thing there has to hook into the next one, and it's complicated. And English is very tough. And sometimes you would arrive up with two brilliant rhymes. You couldn't get a third one. So you had to discard your brilliant rhymes, and they're saying, what did we do wrong? I mean, I know you were a brilliant, but wrong movie, like, you know. Or, you know. And then you would do another spin that wouldn't have ever occurred to you because you had to get the third rhyme. The shepherd had to go out in search of the lost sheep, you know, and bring them back, and you arrive at another idea of the world. And your understanding then of Dante becomes altered because you have to stick to a form. Right. And so the whole idea of form to me is very interesting because you don't know what the thing is until it has a form. And if the form is a set form, a sonnet has to rhyme and scan and blah, 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 etc., you say things that would never have entered your mind. You know, you come across more interesting things than what you had in mind or what you thought you'd felt or what you would say in your poem. You don't know what you say in your poem because of its form.
The tension of the form, you know, helps you to say it. So thank you very much, Kieran Carson.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a reading and conversation with poet and novelist Kieran Carson. This evening's event was presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Europe and moderated by BU Associate Professor of Humanities Meg Tyler. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.